Let's turn from the slopes to the screens. I hope Claire Best is with us now. Claire, are you here?
I'm here. Thank you.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us on Mountain Money. Claire, can we start by asking you to give us a little bit of the background of your involvement with Sundance over time?
Absolutely. So these days I'm a film and television agent. I have my own agency, but I first started coming to the Sundance Film Festival in 1992. At that time I was a documentary filmmaker, and we were attending the Sundance Film Festival to interview some of the filmmakers about American independent cinema. And at that time, Sundance was really still emerging as a festival. And it was right after Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Midnight Cowboy, My Own Private Idaho, Reservoir Dogs, those kinds of films that had suddenly really put American independent cinema really on the map. And so that's when I first came. Then I came back again in 1994 as a sort of hanger-on entourage, friend of a film that was premiering there called The Young Poisoner's Handbook, and watched as that film went through the trials and tribulations of getting sold at the festival. Then I came back in 1996 as a producer of a short film that the photographer, well known for his Weimaraner dog, William Wegman, made. And we were part of a shorts program there. And Gwyneth Paltrow's brother had a film in the same one as our section. And the entire theater was just filled with people ogling Gwyneth Paltrow and Brad Pitt, who was sitting right in front of me. And then since then, over the years, I've been coming back. I was an executive at New Line Cinema for a while. So we had various films that premiered there. And then since 2002, I've been coming as an agent and supporting clients' films or else looking for talent or general networking. So that's my history with the festival.
So, Claire, as an agent, are you looking for the filmmakers or are you looking for the stars?
No, filmmakers. I don't represent any actors. I represent writers, directors, producers, production designers, cinematographers, costume designers, editors. So that's mainly what I do.
The people who do the real work.
Yes.
Ooh, snap. And so, Claire, what catches your eye? What are you looking for when you come to Sundance?
When I come to Sundance, I'm really looking for a unique voice, and I can look back over the years and think of films that would just stand out with unique voices. Perhaps for me, the two that were really knockout were Life of Pi by Darren Aronofsky and also Beast of the Southern Wild a couple of years ago. So those are films that I just thought were so unique that I would never get a chance to see in a normal commercial cinema, and really left kind of a startling impression on me. And, they were groundbreaking films, and there are many others as well. But for me, those were the two that were just completely extraordinary.
Sundance really upends our little town with this massive influx of people and business and traffic. We hear that Sundance, of course, is sort of a focal point for independent film. And we also hear a lot about how somebody sold a movie. Let's talk a little bit about what those two terms mean. What is independent film, and what does it mean to sell your movie?
So independent film is basically a film that is not put together by finance in the studio system. That's, Paramount, Sony, Fox, Disney, Warner Brothers. Those would be studio finance films. So independent films are ones that are put together outside of that system, which generally means coming together with a mishmash of money that might be a mixture of private equity with some soft money of goods and services in kind. It could be some pre-sales to other territories by a foreign sales agent. There could be some gap financing money, some loans. But that is the definition of an independent film for me. And so when those films come to Sundance, they generally will have been financed, but they have not yet found a distribution outlet to pay back their investors and to get the film out there into the world to be seen. So Sundance is sort of a magnet, if you like, for independent films and also for buyers and distributors of independent films who are coming there looking to buy that gem and, you know, get behind it and market it and put it in the theaters across the nation or across the world.
Claire, I imagine...
Sorry, go ahead. No, that's it.
I imagine you have seen a big change in your industry thanks to Netflix and Amazon Prime. How does that affect the economy and dynamics of selling a film?
Absolutely. Well, it does change it quite a bit. And it's really a question in the balance, I think, of whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's a good thing in that Netflix and Amazon can buy projects for worldwide. They have the resources and finances to pay good money and to put the money into marketing those films. Maybe the not such great thing, as we've seen in the last couple of years, that some of the boutique theatrical distributors that are well known, I think, have been slightly pushed out of the marketplace because they simply can't afford the kind of money that Netflix and Amazon can put down. So it's a mixed bag. Overall, I think it's good. I wish there were more theatrical independent buyers still as well.
So Amazon and Netflix they sometimes will put films they buy into theatrical distribution, won't they?
Absolutely, they will. And in fact, Roma, which is a favorite in this year's awards season, is a Netflix film, and you can also go and see that in the theaters as well. And same with some of the Amazon pictures, Cold War, Beautiful Boy, same thing.
So I'm seeing a world where a young filmmaker borrows money from Uncle Jerry, lines up his friends who are technically able, and sort of cobbles together the production of a film to get to Sundance.
They shoot it on their iPhone, right?
And my question is really, well, if they want to get a distribution deal, I'm not sure they can pull off the iPhone. But my question is really, what kind of costs are they usually coming into Sundance having spent to put a decent film on the screen? And then what kind of, let's talk a little bit about the economics of how this might work.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there are famous cases of films being made for next to no money. I think Robert Rodriguez's El Mariachi is the most famous of that. And
Blair Witch.
I might have my numbers wrong, but I think it was around $7,500 or something that he made that film for.
Wow.
But generally speaking, I would say, probably most of the films, or the feature films, let's say, because the docs are a different category, but the feature films that you're seeing at Sundance are probably generally fall somewhere between $500,000 and a few in the lower millions. That would be fairly typical. And the economics of it, well, if you take a film like Beast of the Southern Wild, that film I think was about $1 million, maybe a little under $1 million. And there was no star actor or actress involved, but it was such a unique story. And so it was high risk, but it had an incredible return. If you're trying to put together the film, the money for an independent film, ideally you have an extraordinary and unique story, as well as some notable name actor, because that's the easiest combination for a buyer to risk their money on. The easier of those two, in a way, is the known actors, because they know that somebody will go to the movie theater or download, Netflix, Amazon picture that has, a favorite well-known actor, actress. But it's so raising the money for the film very often requires getting those well-known actors, actresses on board your project, and then going with those actors or actresses to raise the money based on the value of their names. So it can be a bit of a chicken and an egg, because a lot of actors and actresses and their agents won't read scripts unless there's financial backing behind an offer to get them on board. So it's a tricky balance, and you know, sometimes you can find an equity financier who say, I'll back an offer, and then you can go and get your actor or actress, and then based on that you can get more money and more actors, actresses to join the so-called package. And sometimes you have to find a way into getting the material to the actor through their manager, through a friend, through a mutual friend, through just a blind submission with a prayer, hoping that they're going to respond. And they do, you know. So it's not, there's no hard and fast rule. I mean, that's the thing I think I would say that makes Sundance a unique festival is that it really shows very unique voices, and people are excited in the commercial world to see those voices and to give those voices a chance in the commercial distribution world.
And it's certainly true that every year at Sundance we'll see small independent films, and you'll be reading the summary of the film and you'll look at the cast and you'll see a big name and you wonder, how did that happen? Because, you know, I take it that some of these big names must be doing this almost as a flyer, right? Because they're not going to get the kind of money they're going to get from a 20th Century Fox film.
Very true. Well, sometimes actors do it because the subject might be a personal passion subject for them. Sometimes they might do it because they want a career change. They might be really well known as a comedian, and suddenly some fantastic drama comes along and they're willing to cut their rate because it gives them an avenue to show a different side of what they're capable of doing as a performance that the market might not be used to and in the commercial distribution world hasn't fully accepted yet. So it's a way for them to be able to experiment, if you like, with their own new voice. Those are, you know, I think reasons why, you know, actors come on board these independent films for, you know, no money, or not no money, but, you know, very minimal money.
And Claire, you look for unique voices, and I have to ask, I'm looking at a new study that came out from USC about the film industry. It says...
yes, I saw it.
Yeah, 96% of all directors across 12 years and 1,200 movies, 96% of all directors were male, 4% female, only 5 black female directors, 3 Asian female directors, and 1 Latina were hired to direct across 1,200 popular movies. Why are we still seeing this gender discrimination in Hollywood?
It's a very good question, and I actually represent a few female directors, and way before this conversation really came up in the last couple of years, I definitely was out there promoting female directors and had some success, but I was getting pushback because they weren't qualified, or they hadn't made the right film or the right television project, or et cetera, et cetera. That is definitely changing now. There is a high awareness, and I credit the industry this year for really trying to change that. But it's a complicated subject, because I think that, you know, I'm a female, obviously, but I think that we inherently have a unconscious gender bias, in that we will believe in the potential of a male, but we tend to believe in what a female has already accomplished and not what her potential is. And so if you look at films like, I think it's Jurassic World 4, the male director of that, the film that he had done previously, I think was around $800,000, and he suddenly went from jumping from that to doing, you know, Jurassic World or Jurassic Park, which you just would never see happen with a female. It just wouldn't happen, but he did a great job. But somebody believed in his potential. Mm. And if we're going to change the dialogue, in my opinion, We have to, men and women, we have to start believing in the potential of women, not just what they've achieved, because they're never going to get a break unless someone believes in their potential.
So a female director, screenwriter, hopeful, is hearing this interview. What advice would you give her?
My advice would be to challenge anyone who comes to her and says, well, we love this screenplay, but you're unproduced, so we don't know how to market it. Or it's to really think about the challenge. It's one thing if they just don't like the story. Fair enough.
Yeah.
But if someone comes to you and says, well, we write like this, but you know, we want somebody else to direct it because we don't believe in you. Well, my answer to that would be, well, if I wrote the story, I should be the person who knows best how to direct this. So I think that learning how to stand up to the challenge would be my best advice. And people do like being challenged. I mean, in a gracious way. But in my experience from being an agent and a production executive before, you know, it's when you're going to the financiers as an independent filmmaker, it's very easy to know that the financiers know exactly what they're looking for and how they're going to sell it and how they're going to market it. But the truth is they're human beings as well, and they can be convinced. So it's all about convincing. And I mean, Quentin Tarantino is a famous example of this, because I believe the story goes that when he wrote Reservoir Dogs, he wasn't, I don't know if he wasn't sure that he could direct it himself, but I don't think he believed that he had the background to direct it. And he sent it to Monty Hellman. And I believe Monty Hellman saw it. And basically it was Monty Hellman who turned around and said, well, you direct it. I could have got that story wrong, but I believe that's how it goes.
Interesting example, given at least one's perceptions of how Tarantino treats women in his films. I guess what I would, I guess there's a parallel issue obviously going on with Me Too and harassment in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. How do those two sort of line up with each other? Is the existence of this dramatic Me Too movement going to facilitate taking women more seriously behind the camera, just as we are increasing protections for them, those who appear in front of the camera?
Yes, I think it will do. I think the short answer is yes. I think that women are being taken much more seriously behind the camera than they are than perhaps they used to be. And there are many more opportunities, and there are many places that are really actively seeking to create gender parity behind the camera, as well as in front of it. I think it still has a while to properly evolutionize to its correct balance. And part of that has to do with the kinds of stories. There's a perception that women only make, you know, romantic stories or stories that are, you know, in our cultural identity, more female-centric, but actually that's not necessarily true. And, you know, there are females, you know, Catherine Bigelow's one, mm-hmm. you know, who have bucked that trend. So it's as much about the people reading the script, financing the film, believing that women are capable of telling a story that culturally might not be as feminine or female-centric as we're led to believe.
You know, I sometimes think of Sundance as a bit of an iceberg, in the sense that mm-hmm. those of us who live here and attend it go to movies, and we hear the Q&A. But what we don't know is what's going on in terms of that marketplace. How is the give and take going? Are they meeting for coffee to try to negotiate? And, you know, the only fictionalized version of this I remember ever seeing was when they did a segment in this in Entourage on HBO once. And I always often thought it would be a great independent feature film to do what's going on in the business of Sundance. But could you tell us a little bit about how the wheeling and dealing works? Where is it going on? Is it happening at night? Is it happening in the morning? How does it work?
Absolutely. So a lot of feature films that go to Sundance that haven't been sold already have what they call a producer's rep. And the producer's rep is essentially the sales agent on site for the film. So those producers' rep will make sure that the buyers that they want to be attending the first screening are present in the room. And they'll keep very close tabs on who's turned up for the screening and whether they left the screening, at what point they left the screening. And sometimes you'll find a bunch of buyers who have left the screening and you think, oh my goodness, it's not going well. But in fact, what they're doing is they're all in the lobby calling their colleagues, saying, let's make a bid on this, or you need to come and see the next screening right away, or et cetera, et cetera. So it can happen in the lobby. It can probably happen in text in the screening, although there shouldn't be any text going on in the screening. And sort of like any kind of bidding situation, once you have the first bid in, then you have some leverage, because then suddenly you've got something that is a hot potato and everybody wants what I always have this saying about Hollywood is everybody wants what they can't have. So as long as you've got it and they don't have it, you have leverage. The moment that they have it and you've sold it, you don't have leverage, at least for obviously for selling your film. But it's a little bit of a careful strategy that goes on, and the filmmakers and the producers' reps hold their hands very close to their chest of who's making what bids, and revealing at the right time information to other buyers or whoever that might cause those buyers to increase their bids or back off or so forth. And there have been some cases of some really famous sales, like Shine, when Fine Line Features, New Line Cinema, ended up buying Shine, but Miramax went after it, and there was allegedly a physical brawl on Main Street.
Between Harvey Weinstein
and, yeah. I wasn't
one of his earlier criminal acts.
Yes.
Allegedly.
Alleged criminal acts.
Exactly. So there have been cases of, people, you hear of different distributors, bidding late into the night, from their condo rooms or in a room with the filmmakers, and the price goes up and up and up, and then, they close the deal at 3 o'clock in the morning. So that's sort of how it works. And then actually very often, the other thing that people bear in mind when they go to Sundance is that the audience at Sundance tends to love every film, which is very different from festivals like Cannes, where films can get booed by the audience. You just don't see that at Sundance. It is an audience who are there, who are excited to be there, who are excited to watch the film. So I've seen situations where films have had the most fantastic audiences at Sundance, and then the films have been released and they've had a so-so reaction. So the buyers have to gauge where the real general public audience reaction for film that premieres at Sundance, because you do have to sort of take it down a peg or two for the general enthusiasm of being there.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Claire Best, who's been helping us understand the business of Sundance. Thanks for spending time with us this morning, Claire.